Mr. Burnett, do we have to read this?
Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order of the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty. Johnson.
Here.
Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger. Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran. Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Okay, a quorum being present, will somebody move the minutes from February 2nd? Representative Kelly moves the minutes of February 2nd. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. All right. So Representative Woodard.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I understand you have a you would like to move House File 152.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 152 be recommended to pass and referred to the Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have any opening comments?
Yes, I do. I think I'll invite my testifier to come up now, and I'll wait on the introduction of him until he starts his testimony. But House File 152 has to do with the criminal possession or sale of identification documents. This will be a somewhat controversial bill, I think, about as you think about it in your mind as we go through, hopefully, some of the fears you have about this being targeted. Certain groups of people or certain ages of people will be allayed, and we'll have we've got plenty of time for lots of discussion. I'll have, would like to request, Mr. Chair, that Ms. Pirius be allowed to give a walkthrough of the bill as compared to current law and what we're trying to accomplish, and then come back to me if you would. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, who did you suggest we have?
Rebecca Pirius, or
legal staff. Oh, sorry, thank you. All right.
Thank Pirius. You. Mr. Chair and members, House File 152 criminalizes two things. It criminalizes knowing possession of multiple identification documents without permission or lawful authority, and knowingly selling or transferring multiple identification documents, knowing that the recipient is not entitled to obtain or possess that ID. If the violation involves two IDs, the penalty is a gross misdemeanor with a maximum 1 year jail sentence. And if the violation involves three or more IDs, the penalty is a maximum 3 year felony. In the definition, you can find the definition of identification document, and it refers to authentic as well as fraudulent federal, state, and local documents. The rationale behind the bill was to address certain limitations in current law that were of a concern to the author. In your packet, you'll see a chart that lists Minnesota's identity theft and related statutes. And so I thought this would be helpful in looking at some of those concerns. So for example, if you look at identity theft, which is on the first line, you'll see that the penalties are based on the amount of loss to the victim. And in some cases, there's a concern that there might not yet be an actual monetary loss to the victim. Another element in the identity theft statute and other statutes on this list is an intent requirement. So intent to commit another crime, intent to defraud, or intent to sell the document. Another concern is the type of document that are covered by these statutes. For instance, in 609.652 and 171.22, which is on the back of the document, those statutes only apply to driver's licenses and state ID cards. And then some of the crimes are only applying to fraudulent IDs, versus authentic IDs. So the bill is attempting to address these concerns, and I think there's going to be testimony regarding what law enforcement is seeing in the field. With respect to penalties, the rationale was to keep them proportional to what is seen in current Minnesota law and what is seen in other states. And for your reference, there is also a second chart in the packet that lists some of the other states' similar criminal laws and penalties.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Perius. Mr. Chair, do you have any other opening comments, or are we ready for testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this wasn't originally my idea, this bill, how it came to be. I was at a class given, I think, with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in Mankato, and Mr. Flynn came to me at the time to my table and said, we've got a real problem here with the illegal documents and being used in major crimes and having possession of the document not being illegal. And we'd like to work with you on that. And so through conversations back and forth and with legal staff, we've come up with House File 152. I'll introduce my testifier now and let him explain the need for the bill and what he's come across in his work environment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Kevin Flynn. I'm a detective sergeant with the Worthington, Minnesota Police Department, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time today to speak with you and members of the committee on this matter. You're probably familiar with our community. We're in the southwest corner. We're a very diverse population. We're also a gateway into the state of Minnesota with Interstate 90 and Highways 59 and 60 from the southwest. We have a number of people come through, reside, come and go from our community like any other type of organization or any other type of community, excuse me. And based on that, we have contacts with many different people, many different walks of life through various calls for service. Through those calls for service, we have various things that occur, whether it's a traffic stop, a domestic, an assault. We also do benefits fraud investigation, our department does for Nobles County. And as usually goes in the nature of a contact with law enforcement, is that some form or some type of identification is routinely asked for from the person that we're talking to, whether it's a victim, whether it's a witness, suspect, whatever it might be. And during the course of these contacts, some of the things that surface, some of the issues are secondary. The primary reason for being there might be the call for service. Somebody's dog's in my yard, or somebody's assaulted my steps, on somebody's stolen my TV. It doesn't matter what the call is. When we go there, we're looking to identify the people. In the process of doing that, oftentimes we come across situations where we have documents, identification documents that are shown to us, that are given to us, that are clearly documents that are not authentic, or that they're purported to be authentic to the person that's presenting them to us. And in the packet that you have there in point number three, some of the reasons that we determine some of those documents are questionable. One of them is a 30-footer, and that's kind of a raw street terminology in the sense that the document is so poor that you can see that it's not genuine from 30 feet away. There's times when we run a check on somebody through our dispatch center, or our officers do it through their computers and their cars, where no information comes back on the person whatsoever. You'll have situations where a person will not have their correct date of birth, or a person will actually have to retrieve an identification card from their pocket or some type of ID from their pocket to give you an address. We've even had people do that to get the correct spelling of their name. Not illegal in any sense of the way to look at a document to get a name, spelling, or your date of birth, not whatsoever. But it does go to a secondary type of concern in that you're wondering, why is this person having such a problem identifying themselves? There's documents that we see with the address on the document. If you've lived in the community for any period of time, you know that that address doesn't exist. Or you look at the picture on the document and you can tell that that's really not the person that's standing in front of you. Or in some instances, you've dealt with that person on previous occasions and know them by some other name. So those are some of the things that bring this issue to the forefront. How we've handled that in the past, or how law enforcement handles it in the past, is, you know, varies from department to department across the state. The means to currently handle something may be an identity theft case. Thank you very much. Identity theft case or an aggravated forgery case, and sometimes those options aren't reliable, or they aren't even fiscally possible, especially in the case of an identity theft where you would have a gentleman, and I'll give you an example of that when we progress here, but if you've got a victim that calls our department from Southern California, calls our department from some other part in the country, and reports that he's never been to Worthington, Minnesota, much less Minnesota, and he understands that he owns two cars and a house in our city. And from that point on, we're looking at identity theft, but it's tough to bring that person forward to be there as a witness when budgets are tight. It's very tough for a county attorney's office to bring somebody in for that prosecution. In aggravated forgery cases, if we have a situation where a gentleman is, or the person is, if it's an employment situation, if it's a benefits situation, where you obtain documents or search warrants or however you obtain them, and you look at them and the statute of limitations may have expired, you'll have some argue that the statute of limitations pertains to the time they signed the original documents, whether it's in an employment folder, whether it's in some other type of application. There are some that will argue that the only time that the crime exists is when they signed that original document. It's my contention that every time somebody signs somebody else's name, that a crime exists, but that's how some of the gaps are created with identity theft and ag forgery, those miscellaneous situations. Until we actually came forward with this information, I wasn't even aware of Minnesota 144.227, other than through Mr. Cornish's assistance there. And that talks about the sale of a vital record in the state of Minnesota, but it doesn't address the possession issue. Other things that, talk about this issue, the various driver's license statutes, the use of a Minnesota ID or a driver's license by another, unlawful acts relating to a driver's license or the false name to a peace officer, simply don't address the nature of this problem to the extent that that it needs to be addressed. What it boils down to is there's absolutely no functional purpose for Tony Cornish to have a driver's license, a Social Security number, and a birth certificate showing him to be Kevin Flynn. There's no purpose other than maybe the Federal Witness Protection Program. I don't know. And I'd like to go through some examples for you here.
Mr. Flynn, I have a question.
Yes.
So I'll interrupt you.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Mullery.
Just a comment. I think maybe reputation might be a reason.
Thank you, Representative Mullery.
Not just for that one representative, but probably for all of us.
I was afraid that's where that was headed. Thank you, Representative Mullery.
I cite some specific instances here and talk about them in the current sense, even though they are, you know, several years old. Talk about the first instance was from 2004. It's a benefits fraud case where we actually learned the information through a benefits fraud referral from our family services agency. We did a search warrant at the residence, and the gentleman that was listed in the application for the benefits, he wasn't the primary applicant, he was merely listed as a member of the household. He had seven different identities. And those identities were seven distinctly different names, not seven variations of a person's name, but seven different names. There are multiple vehicles involved that were registered and titled to the various different names of this individual, insurance policies, credit cards, all kinds of daily business transactions that dealt with one particular name from that assortment of names. That alone right there, in answering that question or asking that question, what purpose is served by this individual having a driver's license, a birth certificate, a social security card showing this person to be someone other than who he is? That individual did plead guilty in a benefits fraud, ag forgery, and also motor vehicle theft. And as part of the search warrant that we served, we actually found the abstract for the home that he was living in that is listed to one of his aliases. So in all respect to that individual, we can't return that abstract because that's not him. So that's one situation where multiple identities can define how this spreads out or what the far-reaching implications are. Number two is a document vendor case. And there's absolutely no, I shouldn't say absolutely, but Minnesota 144.227 is as close as there is to dealing with it on the state level. There's no state statute that allows state law enforcement to deal with a person that's selling documents. And document vending might not be a common knowledge for you folks, but it's certainly something that exists out there. And the seriousness of it is that Sioux Falls, South Dakota Police Department had a homicide that we assisted in investigating because someone stole the document vendor's inventory, and the document vendor wanted to be reimbursed for what he figured was the value of those documents. He actually said $6,000. And when the person didn't pony up the $6,000, he stabbed him, killed him. I'm not saying that all document vendors are prone to homicidal violence, but in that situation, it did go to that point. In our document vendor case, two women got into a fight, and one of them chose to pick up the phone and call law enforcement and tell us about how the other one was a document vendor. With that in mind, once again, it's not illegal, or at that point it wasn't anything that we felt we had a clear statute to deal with it on. And in the past, we've had the federal authorities that have assisted in investigating that type of situation. But at times, to pique their interest a little bit more, we bring them some evidence of the crime. We bought a birth certificate and a Social Security card in about 30 minutes from this document vendor after this person was identified. Well, what that boiled down to, or what it created, was a federal investigation, and it brought 26 federal agents to a neighborhood in Worthington to execute a search warrant and to complete this investigation. Quite a display of manpower and quite an extensive investigation. One of the things that we came up with from that situation is that there were multiple driver's licenses applied for from that household. And that was just one of the services this person provided. Not only would that person sell the documents, but that person also would take them to the deputy registrar's office in a neighboring county and help them apply for a driver's license. So dealing with document vendors is significant. One of the things that I've come across recently in an aggravated forgery investigation is when I send a request to the Department of Motor Vehicles for information on a driver's license application, they send the information back. One of the things I'm looking for is what Social Security number was used to apply for that driver's license. If it's not that person's number, you know, that's fraud in the basic sense. I got the driver's license application back, or a copy of it back, and the DMV had redacted the Social Security number from the application. I told them it was a criminal investigation. I needed that information. They said they weren't allowed to pass that on. That's just a side note. Going on to my third example, identity theft. Had a gentleman call from Southern California. His name was Cristobal Lopez. And Mr. Lopez, to this day, carries a letter around in his pocket from our department with the picture of someone we identified that is using his identity that's not in custody and is wherever he might be in the United States. Mr. Lopez, the true name Mr. Lopez, is stopped on occasion for whatever. He also does business in Mexico. He comes and goes from Mexico, but he gets stopped at the border routinely because we have an active arrest warrant entered in our computer, in NCIC, for Cristobal Lopez. Hence the need for him to carry this letter in his pocket that I'm the real guy, please don't arrest me. But he's been taken into custody and he's been detained numerous times. We did a search warrant at the house in our city that was the origination or the location we believed that the imposter was living. We recovered various documents there. The bad guy wasn't there, but there are other people that were living there that once again had documents we didn't believe to be that person. We didn't deal with that issue. We were dealing with the identity theft case. One of the gentlemen there gave us a name. We ran the name through NCIC, and the gentleman had an arrest warrant out of Florida for some type of narcotics or some type of serious assault, and he was taken into custody. Well, he swore up and down, and probably rightfully so, that that was the name that he bought. That wasn't his true name, and he ended up having to go back to Florida to answer to that because he happened to buy documents that weren't the true name person or that weren't clean, so to speak. But in that identity theft case, what we came from or what came out of that is the use of Minnesota ID cards and Social Security cards once again to gain employment. And it's not specifically whether a person gains employment. It might be to apply for benefits. It might be for a credit card. It might be for an application for some other type of financial position that that person used those two documents to go forward with. So identity theft is very serious, and it's something that we can deal with, but there's times that that it's not going to be dealt with. The last one on there is probably the most common incident that we come across. Well, we have a traffic offense, and the person in the process of doing their traffic offense provides identification to law enforcement. In our jurisdiction, anybody that goes to jail, whether they're from England, from Canada, from Mexico, from wherever it might be in the world, one of the questions in the booking process is, were you born in the United States? And if the person responds that they weren't, then the jail staff, according to their policy, has that person talk with somebody from immigration to determine if their status is here in the country legally. Nothing to do with the arrest, nothing to do with law enforcement on the street. That's a jail policy that the jail follows for everybody that responds in that manner. That particular individual's name was sent over to immigration. They couldn't respond right away at the time. And what they found is that when they ran that person or that name through the files, that the true name person from Puerto Rico was currently in prison in Puerto Rico, and they sent a document back showing that. I went in and interviewed this guy and asked him what his true name was and so on and so forth, and he told me the name he was using. And I showed him the picture of the gentleman in Puerto Rico, and I asked him if he knew that guy, and he said, no. I said, is it possible that, you know, maybe he lived with you? No. Is it possible that you worked with him? No. I said, well, there's one thing you two have in common, and he didn't know what it was, and I said, well, he has the same name as you. And then he admitted that he was the imposter. The negative aspect of that, having to take the time and the energy to, you know, go through a process and to use resources to work on that type of case is, you know, something that we do on a regular basis. And it's time consuming, but I don't think we have the opportunity to pick and choose what crimes get reported and what crimes get investigated. The benefits of this legislation is that it would allow local law enforcement to investigate the criminal activity of document vending, and it would also allow us to act quicker on the situation where somebody that is using three or more documents in either situation to have an enforcement to impact there. It's kind of a strange perspective, but instead of having a large number of people come to your community and do a search warrant or do some type of action, we can have one local officer or two local officers doing the investigation, as opposed to needing 26 federal officers to come to Worthington to do the investigation. So the fiscal responsibility is there. We hope to be a deterrent to document vendors. That's not going to happen. Document vending is not going away, as are numerous other crimes, but we certainly would hope that it would be a deterrent. And also we see the benefits of covering the gaps in identity theft and ag forgery situation as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Flynn. We have a question from Representative Smith.
Thank you. Mr. Flynn, when you were discussing some of the investigations, you referred and used the phrase time-consuming. I want to explore what that means. I think investigations need to be thorough when we're talking about actions that could deny someone their freedom. So are the investigations or facets of those investigations unnecessary, or is that what you mean by time-consuming, or do you just not want to do them?
Mr. Flynn?
They're very time-consuming, and I agree with you 100% that due diligence and thoroughness is at the utmost top of the list. I guess the thing that's most important there is they are very time-consuming in the amount of different aspects of the investigation that you need to do to get to the conclusion of the case, to do search warrants, to write the affidavits, to serve the various search warrants, and to do a physical search to gather the information. That's all necessary, and that's all something that may come from, you know, a document vending case, or it may come from possession of documents as well. But it's not as likely as it is from the cases that we have now.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, I guess I just want to assure myself, or reassure myself at least, that the testimony I'm hearing from you is designed to support a bill that achieves the reasonable goal of getting at the problem of using identification documents, not necessarily to make your job any less time using of time.
Mr. Flynn?
I understand that, and I agree with you. It's not a means to cut corners. It's not a means to lessen our workload at all. It's something that is probably not a primary investigation. It's something that we come across as a secondary investigation. And instead of doing an aggravated forgery investigation or doing an identity theft investigation, which would be much more significant, and I don't want it to appear like we're looking for a means to do less work, but in a sense of the word, it would be a cleaner, it would be a different type of investigation. It may go to the extent of what an ag forgery or identity theft investigation might be, as far as doing search warrants, doing interviews, collecting different information. But hopefully it wouldn't be that labor-intensive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, or Mr. Flynn, I guess. This bill would clearly have some widespread implications, and particularly like for the city I represent, City of St. Paul. And I'm just curious whether you have vetted or had wide-ranging discussions with some of the folks that would have interest in this bill, such as the Minnesota County Attorney Association, the State Bar Criminal Law folks, or the Minnesota court system, or the DOC, or the Association of Minnesota Counties, or the League of Minnesota Cities. Have you gone through all those folks and got impact from Flint? Them?
Mr. Chair.
Chair.
Representative Johnson, I think the fiscal note that Mr. Carger has, a preliminary, probably talks about DOC and corrections in that respect. And then I did contact the County Attorneys Association and asked them for an opinion, and they're talking about it now. They didn't have enough time to get back with a formal, but you know how the process they go through. But if we progress this bill on to the Judiciary Committee, hopefully we'll get some more light shed on the subject about opinions and weigh-ins.
Follow-up, Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have some concerns about this bill if it hasn't had the chance to be vetted by some of these interested organizations that are really going to have some role to play in the implementation of this kind of legislation. So I think moving forward with it without getting that kind of information is questionable at best.
Mr. Chair?
Well, Representative Johnson, that's what this process for is for vetting. That's the whole reason that we're here, and why the bill was published a while back, to give people opportunity to view it, come and give their testimony, and I'm going to have a lengthy hearing, I'm sure, at the Judiciary, and they'll have another chance there. So,
okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, my question was about the existence of a fiscal note, and I understand now that there's a preliminary note that Mr. Carger has, but I don't think any members of the committee, or at least this member of the committee, has certainly not seen that. I'm beginning to be a little disquieted about the process that we're observing, not only in this committee, but in other committees in which I serve, in which bills that clearly have some fiscal impact are passed out of the committee that has primary jurisdiction over whoever is going to be impacted by that, in this case, among others, corrections. We had in another committee House File 1 that had clear fiscal implications for a couple committees that it went through, and when I asked about fiscal notes, I was told, in spite of what Chair Holberg had said about the procedures and functions of the Ways and Means Committee, that, oh, we'll take that up in Ways and Means. And now you're saying the fiscal implications of this bill that clearly ought to be considered by this committee because it impacts the jurisdiction of this committee is going to be taken up in another committee. Is there some rush about this? Is this such an urgent problem that we can't actually vet this bill in the committee that it ought to be vetted in?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I haven't been here as long as you are, but I can think of numerous times we've passed bills out of committee with no fiscal note, or with a preliminary fiscal note, or with a full fiscal note. This bill is going to go through the Judiciary Committee and Ways and Means, or we can bring it back for possible inclusion. There's a number of different methods, but I sure wouldn't base my decision whether to move this to another committee based just on a preliminary fiscal note. We haven't even got the full impact yet. And even when you get the full fiscal note back, they can be fine-tuned and questioned and reformed after that either way. And so the fiscal note process is a long one, and I don't think we're doing anything in this legislature we haven't done historically in other legislatures before.
Follow-up, Mr. Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Cornish, that may be the case, but you know, what has occurred in the past has not necessarily occurred with my blessing either. And I don't think that the two wrongs somehow make a right principle is one that we ought to be operating on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I know of no rule that it binds the committee for not taking action on the bill because of a preliminary fiscal note. I guess the process that I'm used to is that the fiscal note has even come sometimes when the bill has got to the floor. So I'm sure not going to try to pass a bill with a fiscal note that we can't pay for if you know. So your objections are noted, and I respect your opinion.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, as we all are painfully aware, we're not in this committee or any other committee likely to be looking at incurring additional expenditures in this biennium. But yet, we see a number of bills moving, this being one of them, that clearly would involve some additional expenditure, which I think means if we're looking at the requirement for an overall cut in the budget that is overseen by this committee, would mean that something else is going to have to be cut in order to accommodate that.
Thank you, Representative.
And if we don't even know, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if we don't even know how much we're talking about and what the implications of that might be for other things that we have some value for in this committee, I don't see how we can continue to just say, well, we'll worry about that later.
Mr. Chair?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, we could go tit for tat for an hour on this, but, you know, forecasts change, targets change, fiscal notes change. You can't hold a bill back in committee because you have a preliminary fiscal note and then wait forever to come with deadlines coming. I mean, I think that the DFL and the GOP in past history have sent bills back and forth to committees without a final fiscal note. So we have control of this bill. We can bring it back if we need to. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're well aware of the budget issues. Mr. Carter, any further clarification on this process?
Mr. Chair and members, I could go through the preliminary note if you would like.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. And I should point out, we have 9 new members here. Does everybody know what a preliminary fiscal note is? Or should I give a quick explanation, do you think, Mr. Chair?
I think a quick explanation would be in order. Thank you.
A preliminary fiscal note is a note that's in the system, but it has not been completed yet. I mean, in other words, we might have part of the agencies have signed off, but maybe not all the agencies have signed off. Nor has the executive budget officer. That's the person from Minnesota management that would sign off on the fiscal note saying that they okay everything that's in there. And this fiscal note has been signed off by the Department of Corrections and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And currently what they're estimating is that there is the supervision caseload is unknown, although there could be some impact. But the cost that comes in is that they're estimating 3 beds. In other words, then 2 beds in fiscal year 2012, and then every year after that there will be 3 beds, and these are prison beds. So the estimated cost of that is around $19,000 the first year in fiscal year 12, and then it goes up to $39,013, and then in 2014 your tails, yours, is at it's at $45,000. And they were also under the local impact. They're saying that it is unknown how many local jail beds will be needed. So, and that is just a little summary of the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. And I don't want you to interpret what the departments have said, but is that an indication they don't consider this duplicative, that this is something that is a addition to our current laws that would put people in jail that currently would not be going to jail?
Mr. Chair, yes, these would be people that would be not going to prison. These would be new prison beds that they're estimating.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Flynn, if you could help me out here a little bit. If I possess a fraudulent Social Security card or passport or military card, I'm in violation of federal law.
Mr. Flynn?
Well, I'm not certain of that. I would think you possibly could be, but as far as prosecution for something and that, I doubt it would take place.
Okay. Well, you made a reference to an FBI sting, if I may, Mr. Chair, of 26 people because of false documents.
Right. That was a person that was... Excuse me.
Go ahead, Mr. Flynn.
That was receiving documents in the mail and then reselling them to people that they didn't belong to.
Mr. Chair, so that precipitated FBI investigation with 26 agents.
Mr. Flynn?
What it resulted in was three different parts of the federal government helping out with the case, immigration, Postal Service, and I think Social Security. I don't know if the FBI was involved or not.
For
a follow-up and then one additional question.
Okay.
So basically, what I'm hearing is you got some information, you sent it to the feds, and that sparked an investigation and I'm sure some charges of federal crimes being committed. So my question is, in follow-up, this seems duplicative to me. If there's already federal statutes on it, why are we trying to duplicate it with state statute?
Mr. Flynn?
There are no state statutes to speak of, and if we would have to rely on federal help to work on these cases, that might not be forthcoming. I don't know how they determine who gets involved in what cases and what they're available to work on. They've been very responsive every time there's been that type of situation. And the thing that I think piqued their interest in this particular case was the overall picture. They had other similar investigations going across the country with the origination of where the documents were coming from, and that's what brought this one together in Worthington.
Representative Gauthier, before you go to the next question, Ms. Pirius has, I think, some further clarification on that particular question. Ms. Pirius?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, I did have a chance to look up the federal identity theft statute, and with respect to possession, there are a few provisions. Under the federal law, it's knowing possession with intent to use unlawfully or transfer unlawfully five or more ID documents. Also, knowingly possessing an ID with intent to defraud the U.S., and then knowingly possessing a federal document, knowing that it was stolen or produced without authority.
And Ms. Pierce, is there what is the ramification for that? Are those misdemeanors or felonies? Do you know,
Mr. Chair? I would need to look that up. There are several penalties within the statute.
Okay, my goal is to get to a question that you couldn't answer. So thank you,
Mr. Chair. If I could answer Representative Gauthier's question also, Representative Gauthier, I think what we're getting at here is why bring a bunch of feds in and cause a lot of consternation that has done just that in a lot of cases around the state where a big team comes in, where as if a local department has the tools to deal with it, and violations of state law, it sometimes is handled a lot easier, and under their jurisdiction it's hard to kick an investigation in gear without an actual violation of the law. So I think this helps local law enforcement.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, we could banter back and forth about that. I won't. I'll move to my second question. When you were giving examples of crimes being occurring or suspected crimes, I'm just wondering, and I'll be pretty direct about this. My understanding is that you, Wilmer has a, or Worthington has a significant migrant population of Latino descent people. Were most of these incidents Hispanic people, suspected illegal aliens, or what was the situation?
Mr. Flynn?
Specifically, in just walking through my examples again, number one, the benefits fraud, that wasn't primarily anything to do with ethnicity or a particular case. The second one, a document vendor, once again, it wasn't because of an ethnicity. It just happened to be that's the type of investigation.
Oh, I want to be clear. I'm not accusing you of targeting people on ethnicity. I'm just trying to figure out the dynamics of these situations.
Mr. Flynn?
The best way to put that, and I really didn't want this to dovetail into anything immigration-wise, but it certainly addresses or links to that. The nature of what we see are people that are coming to our area that are undocumented, and the primary folks that we see that are undocumented happen to be of one particular ethnicity, and not because we've selected that ethnicity to highlight.
Right, I understand that.
Representative Gauguin, follow up?
Well, just a couple of comments, I guess, from where I'm sitting. I come from a community that's 95% European descent, so... But it seems to me that we're making some duplicative efforts, federal law, and we are kind of making it a little messy, linking into enforcing immigration law, which is clearly a federal jurisdiction, and I'm very uncomfortable with both of those situations and have no intention of supporting this bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gauthier. Any comment on that? Representative Mulery, do you still have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've got, right off the bat, what if Representative Cornish and I are roommates over at the Kelly Inn?
Heaven forbid.
Give a lot of people heart attacks. Do I possess the documents that he has sitting out on the table or that I see in there?
Mr. Flint?
I would think that I would be, looks to me like I would be, fall under this law if he has an illegal document or vice versa.
Mr. Flint, now.
No more so than the person sitting next to you or the person riding in your car. I think the possession clearly goes back is constructive possession of who those documents show that person to be. And permission is also an aspect of it.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, Mr. Mulery, follow up.
We got to wait until you come back. What about parents and child? That's another situation that I guess I don't understand exactly how this fits.
Mr. Flynn.
I believe if a parent or even a sibling had another sibling's documents, that wouldn't show if you and Mr. Cornish were together and happened to be siblings, I don't think those documents would show you to be him or him to be you. The possession clearly goes back to a person trying to present themselves as another person, not simply the possession that you have.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, I've got quite a few questions, I guess. And I know there's some things that we might be trying to get at here that are serious problems. I know in talking to... businesses, that identity theft is an enormous problem. As we all know, it can be a problem for individuals. But I also don't know that I want to get into something like this for, you said, used to gain employment. I don't know if that's quite steps up to a really horrible thing. If there's not something being covered up there, I'm not sure. But how we already have quite a few, my understanding is, laws that would get at the things that are real problems. Why I'm not seeing the difference in that, and I haven't, since this just came in about a little over, what, about 10 business days ago, I haven't had a chance to see what prosecutors or I know cops and businesses have told me about the identity theft from businesses. But on the other hand, cops are also at least in my city and some of the surrounding suburbs, very worried about getting perceived as being enforcing immigration laws in any way. My police chief has come right to me and said, you know, you're going to kill a lot of our investigation of crime if you get into that issue. And so, personally, I still am not able to figure out why we need this and what we're going into. Even when I was in college, a lot of people had ID cards. I didn't happen to have one, but they weren't true. But an awful lot of people I knew had them. You know, making felons or putting somebody in jail for a year because of they go down to the corner bar and get in. Seems to me that that's pretty extreme. So that it seems like there's some really weird things that could happen from this law. And you've got a lot of things in here that don't look like the kinds of things that are neat. You know, I've never heard a cop say that somebody had an immigration visa to steal or to defraud Target or an adoption decree that they used to defraud Target or anything like these types of things.
Thank you, Representative Morey. I assume that's a good portion of your questions, all wrapped up in one. And also, I would comment that I think your statute of limitations on anything you did in college is probably okay. I think we probably passed that. But Mr. Flynn, do you have some comments on Representative Morey's questions?
And I appreciate your comments, and I do agree that we don't want to get into immigration issues, but once again, we do. This is something that does link back to that. Our city does not enforce immigration laws. Immigration is a federal civil issue. We come into contact with people, as I pointed out, through various criminal situations. Through those situations, we become aware of other particular situations through identification. I'm not talking about a kid that goes to the corner bar to buy a six-pack of beer. That kid usually doesn't have a birth certificate, a Social Security card, and a Minnesota ID showing him to be somebody else. From my experiences, he'll have some type of ID, but not three pieces of identification. Now, that's the purpose of that. We don't have the opportunity or the ability to have federal law enforcement come into outstate Minnesota for cases that are of this nature. They don't have the time. They don't have the resources to pursue these cases. We've got no particular jurisdiction to do anything on the federal level. With that in mind, and I don't see this legislation as being something that a particular agency would run out and use as a primary means to enforce the law. But as you're investigating other things, this comes up. If you're doing an investigation of a burglary and you happen to go into a house and come across somebody that's got narcotics, that turns that investigation towards narcotics. If you've got something that is a domestic assault or some type of abuse case, a benefits fraud case, and you go into that case and you see something that's identity related, that's where this bill comes into play. Why has that person got three or more documents showing them to be another person? And that's the main issue of my interest here.
Thank you, Mr. Flint. Representative Mueller, I don't know if you have additional questions, but I'm going to give an opportunity for make sure we have plenty of opportunity for the public as well as Representative Nornes, and we can get back to you on final comments as well. Representative Nornes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't have a lot to add to the discussion except that I think there is a sense of urgency, and someone was questioning that, but I think there is with the identity theft problems and the sale of documents. I think that the faster we get this in effect here in Minnesota, the better off our public will be.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cornish, do you have any further testifiers or final comment?
No, from the testifiers, but Mr. Chair, just a comment is that some question came up as to why we need this, but I thought my presenter gave about a half an hour of why we do, why the current statutes aren't enough in this. I just want to say this is by no means intended to target a certain group of people. This is just, we're after people that are using documents illegally, whatever that happens to lead. We're after the possession of illegal documents and identity theft and financial crimes and anything where it leads, and for more local authority to pursue these crimes. So thank you very much, and I hope that you would vote for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this being a public hearing, are there any other members of the public who would like to testify in as a proponent of this bill? And Representative Hilty, you have an additional question. Is this for?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. A question for Representative Cornish. According to the preliminary fiscal note, Corrections is anticipating 3 convictions a year as a result of this bill. Do you agree with that estimate, that what will be accomplished by this bill is that 3 people per year are convicted?
Mr. Flynn or Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, by no means to be flippant, but I don't know what to think of that fiscal note. As you and I know, who knows what could happen? There could be 0 arrests. There could be 10 arrests. There's no way to predict it. These notes are, some of them are just a shot in the dark, and I think you and I have seen fiscal notes that we thought were absurd, some that were right on, and some that we probably haven't paid attention to. To me, this fiscal note is minuscule in the fiscal notes that we've seen. You know, in the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, it's something we have to deal with, but I was surprised how low it was actually myself.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could follow that up, Representative Cornish, I kind of agree with you, but I'm wondering, what is your estimate of how many convictions might be resulting from the passage of this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, no idea, because I could go out and make 2 DWI arrests 1 year and 20 the next. It depends on a lot of, you know, demographics and population and the weather and everything else. I mean, it's so unbelievably hard to predict. That's why we ask for fiscal notes, because we don't have all the capabilities to gauge that. And the fiscal note came back, and now we have to deal with it. I have no idea if that's even close.
Okay. Mr. Flynn, did you look like you had something to follow up on that, or we're good? Okay. Mr. Moria, is this question for Mr. Flynn? Or
yes.
Is it, okay.
He mentioned that we needed this because the statute of limitations on an applicable law is too short, and I was wondering why we couldn't change the statute of limitations on that law that is a problem way back, because I wrote down that you said we needed this because of a statute of limitations on, I don't know if it's the ones that Representative Smith cited or which ones, but...
Mr. Flynn?
It was on aggravated forgery, and the nature of the statute of limitations on a felony, this particular felony is 3 years, and I don't know that you could pick and choose on which, you know, I guess that's a legislative issue, whether you can pick and choose on which ones you want to extend or how that gets extended, but that's the basis of it. That particular crime has that statute of limitations. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, just one point quick.
Okay.
Yes, we do pick and choose on statutes.
Representative Slocum, is this for Mr. Flynn?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. This is for everyone as we think about this. In line 2.4, the effective date, we've heard about how we've got to get this on the books, we've got to do this quickly. The effective date of this is August 1st, 2011. Mm-hmm. We have plenty of time to be deliberative. We have plenty of time to get the input from other groups. I just don't want to see us race when really race to get her done when August 1st, 2011 is the date this would go into effect. So we have time.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Is there any other members of the public that would like to testify as a proponent? Yes, sir, please come down and state your name, please, for the record. Thank you, Mr. Flynn.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I guess before this testifier takes us in, I'd like to ask you to keep him very short because it has absolutely nothing to do with my bill. It it wants to inject a juvenile, address juveniles using IDs for alcohol and tobacco, and as far as I can tell, it couldn't have much to do with my bill, and I've offered him a start another bill if he'd like, but go ahead, go for it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Chairman Cornish's point here, we do want to make sure we've got plenty of opportunity
I'll
for
be
the
within a minute or two.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead. Please state your name for the record.
Bob Poplin. I train bars and restaurants in Minnesota. I've been doing it for 25 years. The most common use of...
and I'm sorry, I missed your name. What was your name, sir?
Robert Poplin.
Okay, thank you.
And the most common use for a fake ID in the state is buying cigarettes and alcohol. And the bill is focused on producers, not users. And I was thinking that you might be able to pay for the bill by just having a $500 ticket like they do in Wisconsin. And the police then can pay for the enforcement just by writing the ticket. For the abuse of alcohol and the use that underage kids get access to alcohol through false IDs, I thought it might be just something to put in. And the only way that they put it in is, without changing anything, is intentionally carries an official ID not legally issued to him or her, an identification card obtained under false pretense, an official card which has been duplicated to give false information, and just stick in a ticket for $500 and leave it go at that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Poplin.
Thank
you
for
your testimony. Is there any testifiers in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, are there any members of the public who would like to be heard in opposition to this bill? Okay, seeing none, let's go with any additional questions that there might be. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I apologize for running out. We had a meeting at the governor's office on a whole other issue, but I badly wanted to be here with you all vetting this. I have several, but I won't do all of them because I suspect some of these questions have been raised. I'm wondering if perhaps Detective Flynn can help me with something.
Or Mr. Flynn? Thank you.
And Detective, you have a wonderful community in Worthington. I've had the privilege to visit it repeatedly over the years, and it's a terrific community that you work in. But on the issue of the fiscal note, so the fiscal note is basically projecting three statewide convictions under felonies. And I do think it is important for us to get a real strong sense about what it is we're biting off here, regardless of the merits of whether we're doing it, you know, what is the cost side of this, to the state. Because if we get that wrong, eventually there's going to be a cost, whether the fiscal note gets it right or not. And then we put tremendous, pressure on our correction system unfairly. So my question is, fiscal note is, as I understand it, saying three convictions statewide. Is it your understanding, just based on your jurisdiction, that less than three individuals, if this is enacted in Worthington alone, would be charged, let alone convicted, would be charged with felony counts? Is that, I mean, obviously we're guessing here, but that's the best we can do here. And so based on your experience, are you in a position to tell us that there'll be less than three people out of the Worthington area in a given year that will be charged with felonies as a result of this?
Mr. Quinn?
I think there would be probably more people charged. Where it would go from there, whether, once again, this would be probably something, not a primary part of an investigation, but something that surfaces as a investigation goes. I don't know that it would be, I just don't know. I can't speak for the county attorney's office, but I don't know to what extent the charges would carry forward. In some cases they certainly would. They'd be the primary charges, but I don't see that as a general happening.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Mariani, just to that question, I think Mr. Carter has some additional information that may be helpful on that question. Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just for clarification's sake, the three would be just prison beds. I think the estimate is that they're estimating there could be more convicted However, the others that are convicted would either serve probation and or probation and maybe some jail time.
Okay.
So the estimate on that, they're saying could be as many as 50 offenders per year.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter. Representative Mariani.
So, Mr. Chair, so now we have a new threshold, as many as 50 offenders a year, if you're projecting back. And obviously there's guesswork here, but we have a history of connecting bedtime with charges, and so I suspect that's where the 50. So, you know, then again, you know, Detective Flynn, 50 statewide, is that a number that seems to fit what you're seeing out on the streets of Worthington?
Mr. Flynn?
Well, once again, sir, I see it as something that if there is a group of charges, say if it's a benefits fraud case or some other type of case, whether it's a plea agreement or how that's resolved, likely that there would be jail time for one of those offenses. I don't know that it would be primarily from this bill. There would be situations, I believe, that would stand alone where this bill would be the primary charging. I just don't have any idea what it, like Representative Cornish said, you could have two arrests in 1 month, you could have 22 arrests the next month. So it's difficult to know how that would work out. I would estimate that it would be, we would have more probably charges than just three. I know that, you know, following all the way through to the prison end of things, but I do believe there'd be more charges, and I believe 50 statewide would probably be reasonable, if not a little bit on the shorter end.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Detective. One final question. Have you, you mentioned your county attorney. Has your county attorney weighed in on this particular proposal?
Mr. Flynn.
He has looked at it, and he's made comments that it would be a useful tool, but he's not taken any position as to whether he supports it or is against it. All
right. Thank you. Thank you, Detective.
All right. Representative Mowry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking and trying to figure out all that this might encompass. If I'm working for 3M and I have a 3M identity card and I leave employment there and you stop me a week later, it looks like I'm picked up here because I have something that I'm not entitled to possess. Seems like all of a sudden I'm captured in this bill.
Before you answer that, Mr. Flynn, Ms. Pierce, do you have some additional commentary on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the definition of identification document would only include those issued by or purported to be issued by the U.S. government, state, or local government. So I don't believe a private company photo identification would fall.
Mr. Chair, then if I have a house ID and 3 months after I leave office or 3 months or 3 days after I leave working here, as unfortunately a lot of our DFL staff suffered just last month or two, this would apply to that, I would think, then, because those are issued by a state or local government.
Representative Cornish, you or Mr. Flynn?
Does that show you to be somebody other than who you are?
Representative Maury?
Not your title.
I don't see that it limits to show some that it's somebody other than who I am. I don't see that.
Ms. Spirius.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll just point out that the possession has to be of two or more identification documents, and knowingly without possession or lawful authority.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would be without a lawful authority, and I'd it's possible that you could have two from a state or local government. I'm not offhand thinking of it, but I know that you could.
Representative Cornish, any comments on that?
No.
Okay.
Unless there's a specific question, but I, yeah. Unless there's any other comments, I
do have some questions.
I have would rather not close with any comments because it'll generate 14 more scenarios.
Okay. Representative Mariani, did you have a follow-up question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have questions of the author. I just wanted to make sure I initially had an opportunity to have a conversation with Detective Flynn. And so it sounds like we're kind of winding down here toward a vote, and so we want to make sure we have asked any questions that need to be asked. And so, Representative Cornish, you know, this kind of legislation obviously has impact on the system. And so we've got lots of different folks in the system. We have county attorneys associations. We have the courts themselves. Obviously, we have law enforcement, you know, broader, and we have different communities in law enforcement. Have you solicited support from those various groups for this particular piece of legislation? For instance, are the Statewide County Attorneys Association asking for this? Have they had a chance to look at this and offer advice to you in regards to the bill?
Representative, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, yes, I sent an email to the, I believe he's the director of the county attorney. He's their representative of the County Attorneys Association, and he's forwarding it on to their committee to look at. And hopefully would have some answer back, but nothing yet. That was just a few days back. So.
And Mr. Chair, I won't belabor it because I believe Representative Hilty raised this question, made the point earlier about a discomfort because, you know, we're a policy and a finance committee, and you know, we want to make sure that, you know, off, you know, in the first, you know, goal at legislation, the policy folks are very comfortable with the policy before we get into the finance discussion. It's hard to be comfortable when the main stakeholders have not had a chance to offer us advice. What Representative Cornish, so there's talk of identity theft as the issue here. Have you had an opportunity to talk to, say, the Commerce Department or consumer advocacy groups, you know, who look out for and advocate on identity theft to see whether or not this is something that they would want and, or that they propose or that they would support?
Mr. Flynn or Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, I suppose we all have different styles. In my 8 years since I've been here, I don't go out and solicit input from a lot of groups. I take input. If anybody's worth their salt as far as lobbyists or an organization, I was a lobbyist for 6 years, and I was tuned into the website, and a number of organizations have contacted me about this, but not with support or non-support. I would think that the county attorneys knew about it the day that it was introduced. And so the short answer to your question is no, I haven't gone out and solicited support. I have a lot of support from different law enforcement agencies, but not in writing.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. We all have different styles here, and we try to respect those. However, we're also individually all, you know, asked to vote on things. And so for me, you know, I like to hear from the groups as I vote on things, whether or not there's going to be an impact here, particularly when there's an issue of cost related to this. Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, you know, you had a bill last week where I asked the question of federal redundancy.
About what?
About federal redundancy.
About what?
About federal redundancy. And, you know, one of the arguments behind that bill that you and the proponents put forward is that, you know, basically we shouldn't be redundant. We shouldn't be doing work the federal government does. It costs us, and, you know, we need to save money in the state. We need to not overburden our local law enforcement officials with having to, in that case, have to do with, you know, background checks, to do work that the federal government does. What we're hearing a testimony here is that we're primarily talking about federal documents, which are clearly within the purview of the federal government. We do know that there are federal laws that, while not perhaps align point by point with, I believe, what you have before us, nonetheless, there's tremendous overlap, and we also know that there are prosecutions that are handed out in federal court relative to fraudulent use of documents. And so I'm just wondering, you know, and I hope this doesn't come across flippant, but I'm looking for sort of consistent approach in this committee. Is it now the posture of this committee that we will in fact be redundant with enforcement mechanism that the federal government already does, that it is appropriate for us to spend more money to cover the work that the federal government is already spending money, which we're paying for by as well. So maybe just quickly talk to us about why this is so different in terms of the other bill relative to the issue of redundancy and taking on a responsibility that the federal government clearly already has.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, the best way to answer that is, maybe you missed it in the testimony before, but our testifier, Kevin Flynn, was talking about a situation in his community where a number of agents came through. And you've probably seen that highlighted, and I think it impacts on groups that you would be worried about. There was big things about federal stings. So I would think a federal sting or a lot of federal agents would be the last thing that you would want to see, and I, coming into a local community. What Mr. Flynn said, that this gives the local tools to take care of things like that locally, if it's a violation of state law, to better take care of on a local level so you don't have to rely on the feds. And I don't think it's redundant because basically the feds aren't doing their job. I pick up people all the time that have multiple IDs and all sorts of questionable circumstances and call. Nobody will do anything about it, and it relies on us, and we turn them loose. And so Mr. Flynn, I think, did a good job of testifying why this helps the local authorities and keeps the federal authorities from coming in unless we need them to assist an investigation, and upon our call they come and help us. But I think things are better handled much better locally by our own police, and I think this allows them to do that. It gives them a tool to kick in an investigation because there is a violation of the law and to thoroughly investigate it, and if they need help then they can call it instead of having to rely on somebody to come in and solve a local problem.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Mariani, you have the final question here.
Fair enough. I think I'm hearing a different argument than what we heard last week in terms of the principle that guides the actions of this committee, where we heard law enforcement people saying, you know what, we're actually doing a better job relative to that issue. But to be continued.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. And I think good presentation of the bill, and I think certainly shows that a need, especially in the area of identity theft, so I certainly encourage members to support this bill. Mr. Chair, would you like to renew your motion?
I'd like to renew my motion for House File 152, recommended to pass and to move to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee.
Okay. Representative Cornish renews his motion for House File 152 to be passed and re-referred to the House Judiciary Committee. And by voice vote, all those in favor of moving this bill signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion is carried. Our next meeting is on Tuesday, February 8th at 10:15. Same bat time, same bat channel. And this committee is now adjourned.